In order to practice meditation, it is important to have what we call the right view. And the right view allows us to engage in the practice of meditation in a way that is open and that may help us to realize this right view. So we start by stating a little bit the vision that one may realize or deepen through the practice of meditation. So speaking about the right view is not a way to try to convince ourselves of a certain way of believing in reality, but rather giving a possibility that we may explore. If we don't have this possibility, it's difficult to explore in this way. Explorer to discover America needed to have a vision of the earth as a spheric. If they had a vision as being flat, they would never go in one direction hoping to get back to where they started from. So they needed a vision. So in the same sense, for the practice of meditation, in order to open to discovery that are not common, we need right view. And I want to speak tonight about the right view. And in doing so, also speaking about the different way that one can understand duality and therefore non-duality. Not believing to start with that they all say the same thing. That sometimes there is a lazy way to read, you know, Asian text, or to listen to Asian teacher, or to Asian vision, just to say they all say the same. One doesn't check, really. It is easier to say they all say the same, so therefore I don't need to understand anyone. You know? So I would like to question a little bit of that. And especially when we discover that they themselves were saying they did not agree. So, more than 1,000 years later, we come and say, they agree. Well, they did not agree at the time they were together. So, I think we could at least hear what they were saying. And to understand, or maybe to choose one vision of duality and non-duality. I think this makes more sense for me. That's fine. But I think it's important to see the distinction. To be made. So we are not bound by reality. We are bound by our imagination and the belief in this imagination. And that's of course very important. If we were bound by reality, then freedom will not be a possibility. So only if we are bound by imaginary bounds, can we speak about freedom? So not bound by reality, but what is then reality? Certainly, a lot of answers have been given to what is reality, and we'll explore that a little bit from this perspective. For some Theravada, ultimate reality, that which can be found when we are not stopped by imagination, ultimate reality for some Theravada consists in various elements. Sometimes they speak about 57 elements of ultimate reality. Speaking about the mind and mental factors and matters and nirvana, sometimes reduced in nama rupa, the mind and matter. So they say that is ultimate reality when we get rid of all our preconception or beliefs. Then if we get down to the experience, that what we will find those ultimate reality. And therefore, all the meditation is being organized in order to discover ultimate reality and not to stop at beliefs, imagination, concepts, to get to this ultimate truth. And it is very clear when we hear instruction in some system, it is very clear that the context of the practice, sometimes we hear some teaching about meditation, and when we ask questions, they say, well, we are not concerned with philosophy. But it's not possible. If you start to do meditation, there is a belief of what you can reach or what it is about. So you cannot just escape in saying we are not dealing in philosophy. We need to be confronted, not that we will overdo the philosophy, but still, there is some element of vision that are there as a ground of the practice. So it makes sense if you believe that ultimate reality, ultimate truth, is made of nama rupa, mind and matter. It makes sense that in the practice, one would open oneself to discover what are those ultimate truths. And then they are described as being impermanent, as being selfless and unsatisfactory. That we know very well, this aspect of truth or reality. So that is a background for a certain way of practicing vipassana, a very beautiful and deep way of practicing vipassana. So when this Theravada state, that ultimate reality is made of nama rupa, it's very clearly a dualistic way. It's nama and rupa. And they don't pretend to go beyond duality. In this system, there is no discussion about the problem that would arise from duality. Now, in many other systems, Hindu and Buddhist system, the confusion, imagination that does not allow us to see truth or reality is duality. Duality is a structure of confusion that does not allow us to see reality. So duality, we understand, it means two things at least. But do they mean the same two things when they speak about non-duality? Do they have the same vision that the confusion holding to duality, hold to the same things that we need to go beyond or to see through their imaginary nature? So we see that in the Hindus speak about non-duality, about the Advaita, very strongly. We also find that in Christian mystics, some Greek philosopher, and also in the Buddhist tradition. No, I don't mean they don't speak in other tradition. I'm just naming a few. So do they mean the same thing? I'd like to explore what is this confusion that is held as being duality. We find, I think, in earlier sutra, already in the early tradition, we find elements questioning the duality, especially here. The one I want to quote is questioning the reality of the duality of subject and object. Very clearly stated. In this sutra, the Buddha said, speaking to the monks or meditators, he said, whatever the in this universe, the Brahmas, Indras, Maras, and the priests, and the kings and princes, and common people, whatever they have seen, heard, touched, thought, this I have seen, heard, thought. So the Buddha is making it clear, he has no deficiency. It's not that he doesn't see something. He said, I have seen the same. It's not that what they perceive, hear, or even think that is not known to me. He said, if I were saying that is not known to me, that will be wrong, I will be lying. So I know that. Saying is not disconnected with the common reality of people or even gods, you know, devas and indras and brahmas, maras. He said, yet, when the Tathagata, when seeing, seeing the Tathagata, I mean the Buddha, does not create a scene, to be seen, and a seer. When hearing, the Tathagata does not create a heard, to be heard, or hearer. So in this sense, it does not create an object and a subject. Speaking for the five senses, in the same in thinking. So in this sense, in this sutra, the Buddha says he is free from bondage, because he does not create this duality of a subject and object, a seer and something being seen. So we find already in the earlier sutras is questioning, at least in this sense, from the duality of subject and object, that is being very often questioned. We'll find in some other sutra also a few other where this statement is very similar, where the Buddha states very clearly that he is not holding to a seer and a seen. So just resting in the experiencing, one is expressed in this sense, in seeing that it's just seeing, in hearing just hearing. So just hear means no seer and no object. It's just the experience of seeing, just the experience of hearing, just the experience of thinking. Now this statement is quite short in the sense we could explore what does it mean, just seeing in seeing, just seeing, in hearing, just hearing. One may understand that or experience that in different ways. So we may wonder if we get through the confusion of duality, what are we left with? And do all the system agree to what then are we left with when we rid of the confusion of duality? Here we could imagine that we are left with, in some sense, consciousness, in hearing just hearing and seeing just seeing. So it seems that there is at least experiencing, there is at least consciousness. I don't mean that what it said, but we could imagine that could be understood in this way. There's just pure consciousness experiencing. In the Hindu tradition, the duality is really expressed through the duality of Atman and Brahman, that has to be seen through, and therefore there is no duality between the Atman and the Brahman. Atman being the self, in a non-confused sense, and Brahman we can see in the text and already in the early Veda, that is, the Brahman is pure consciousness, is truth and bliss. It's described already in the Vedas very clearly as being not changing. It doesn't change. It's pure consciousness, bliss and being. And the Atman, which means that the self in a nearly impersonal sense of every being is the same. It is this boundless consciousness and being and bliss. So in the Hindu tradition, what we are, in Advaita, it's certainly Hindu tradition is very vast, but in Advaita, what we are left with when we are rid of duality is the Brahman. Pure consciousness. And oneness. That what we are left with, finally, ultimately. What does ultimate exist when confusion is gone? Is the Brahman consciousness, being, and bliss. So that is the ultimate truth. And reading many Hindu texts, it clearly expressed and usually beautifully expressed constantly. Expressed as being the one and the ultimate truth and ultimate consciousness. So that what any meditation in this system should aim at, it is to realize that our consciousness is nothing different other than Brahman. Any belief that it is different is confusion and bondage. Reaching this timeless consciousness, unborn. When we see the vocabulary that is being used here, we find very similar vocabulary used in the Buddhist tradition. Sometimes we read a text, we could not say, this is belonging to this tradition, this belongs to another tradition. I was reading a text comparing early Advaita and Buddhist and checking some quotation, not reading the background, I could not say where they were coming from. Seemed they could apply to both traditions. And we will see why. And in this, I read in the Veda, it says, the pure consciousness has no birth, no destruction. It is innate shining, like space, it does not change. And to take a quotation from Ramana Maharshi, the I which rise will also subside. That is the individual I or the I concept. That which does not rise will not subside. It is and will be forever. That is the universal I, the perfect I, on the realization of the self. So here we see the expression of a self in a non-egoic sense for the meditators, that is limitless, that is not depending on time, boundless, not born, that what should be realized. So here there is a clear statement or valuation of the sense of I, although it's not very clearly not a limited and egoistic sense of self. Yet the Buddha was constantly reluctant to any such a statement, although it may not appear very early in the Hindu tradition, but he really, we could see in the sutra that always reacted, did not want any kind of statue for the sense of self, you know, as permanent, as not changing and boundless. This is very clearly in all the sutra, very clearly negated. We see that this kind of language, at least in the earlier sutra, is not really promoted. On the contrary, is really not accepted. And think that is the confusion of, again, with the Buddha was teaching. Yet we find in the Buddhist tradition also some school or some writer that slowly moved a little bit away from this teaching from the earlier sutra, and Dogen, the great Zen teacher from Japan, was criticizing some Buddhist teacher in Japan, and I think it's already in India, that were holding the mind. He said that people who say the mind is eternal, immobile, in past, present, and future, as it is beyond light and darkness, we name it spiritual knowledge, we name it also the true self. So Dogen was again that. He said that some call them, he said, those people are not Buddhist. Now, we are not going to fight with Buddhists or not, because it is a useless fight. But we see Dogen, I don't know, 13th, 14th century maybe, quite long ago already, seeing that within the Buddhist tradition there are expressions sometimes here of the true self, which is a little bit disturbing for a reader of the older sutra. How can one express oneself in such a way? So it is to say, here I don't want to take this tradition and start to compare it. I will take the oldest tradition and also the way it has expressed. It has been expressed by Nagarjuna, for example. So I think staying very close to the Buddha's teaching, yet seeing the outcome of what was the teaching. So we see there is not holding the view of ultimate truth as in the Theravada finding elements, but I think in a more radical and more subtle way. Trying to explore from this point of view. And that why sometimes it's disturbing because we read in texts and some statement that seems to be really not in agreement with the earliest teaching of the Buddhist tradition. Again, there's no statement of a true self. That seems very strange. We could explore consciousness and see why, in a sense, this confusion to take consciousness as self is very common. Very often there's a confusion at a lower level of reflection to believe that the consciousness is a self, and even at a much deeper exploration to believe that the consciousness is a self. But tonight I want to focus on duality and non-duality. Yet a few more words about that. It seems that most of the meditators, yogi or mystics, when they try to inquire into reality, they follow some kind of similar attitude. I'm not saying they all go to the same, but in their exploration, they wonder if we do not stop at any belief. Not stopping here and believing in that or that, any preconception, what will we find finally? So they see, like Master Eckhart said, one need to get rid of temporality, of personality and multiplicity, seeing that all those temporality, multiplicity and personality are concepts we're holding on, getting rid of all that, then what one is left with. Saint Augustine said, when I'm looking within myself for the ego, for me, I don't find anything but the divine light. Here we can mean consciousness. So in the same sense, they all try, let's not stop at any belief, any concept. What will we find? And if we take a description of a Thai master describing in a very simple way, concentration on breathing, meditation on breathing. Very simple. He said, well, when the mind gets quieter and quieter, there's a very, very few movement, and at a time, at a point, it's lost its interest in the experience of here, the sensation of breathing, and finally, the mind or consciousness just rests on itself, and it's just pure knowing. So we see, very simple exploration. Just breathing, but we are not so much concerned in this context, not so much concerned by sensation, not trying to discover anything about the sensation, either the impermanence or whatever, but just not holding, not keeping any interest in that, and then finally consciousness rests upon itself, and it's just pure knowing, describing that, not pretending that it is ultimate truth. So it is very common, in a sense, when one does not want to stop at beliefs, a concept that one finally is left with is consciousness. Consciousness devoid of any object or thought, because the mind at this time is not concerned, is not interested in that. Therefore, the consciousness stays within itself. We see a natural movement that finally leads us to this pure consciousness, to use a word. It is a thing that to discover that in one's own meditation, and it is another aspect to take that as the ultimate truth. That is different. So for some, this pure consciousness will be the ultimate ground of being or in existence. That is a truth. So everything is appearing from that. Everything is the manifestation. We can give different name to this pure consciousness, either just pure consciousness or the Brahman or whatever. So for some, that is the ultimate reality, that the ultimate truth. And anything appearing is just an appearance of this pure consciousness. So anything appearing does not appear, really. There is nothing that does really come into being and go out, because there is only pure consciousness appearing, taking the aspect of this object, or this person, or that person. So in this sense, nothing is arising and nothing is disappearing. There is nothing but pure consciousness. All the rest is illusion. It is illusion because only pure consciousness, only the Brahman is the truth. All the rest is an illusion. Now we find something in Meister Eckhart. He said that the creature, whatever is created, is nothing because it receives its being from another, which means from God. So anything that appear and exist, you know, human being or animals or things, they are nothing because they receive their being from God. Only God is, if you like. All the rest is nothing. So we have the same. Here the ultimate is God, but that all the object and being are just nothing. Ultimate here is God. Now, in the Madhyamaka philosophy of Nagarjuna, really deeply rooted in the Buddhist tradition, even in the earliest Buddhist tradition, so that things are emptiness because they are depending on other for their being. So everything is emptiness because they receive their being from other, they are depending. But this emptiness also does not exist truly. This emptiness is also in the way of being of this thing that has no true existence. And there is no ultimate ground for that. Things are conditioning each other, but not one of these things has true existence. So we will find in Madhyamaka philosophy a statement that nothing comes into being or goes out of being. Exactly as we'll find in some Advaita text, nothing comes into being, goes in, out of being, because only the Brahman is the truth. But in Madhyamaka, the way they say it's completely different, because there is no ultimate truth. So nothing comes into being and goes out of being. So the same statement we can read and say, well, they say the same, but they don't say the same. The ground is very different. Now it's not only, if you like, a theory, a philosophy. The way one will practice meditation will be quite different if one is seeking, so to speak, to reach this ultimate ground of being that is pure consciousness, or if one is not seeking any ultimate ground of being. There's a very great difference here. And I think that's quite important to acknowledge that. And one may choose whatever system one wants. It's no problem. But to say lightly that they are the same, I think it's not very serious, it's not very respectful, as I said, a lazy way to say they all say the same. And Shankaracharya, the great Advaita philosopher, was criticizing the Buddhists for their vision of impermanence, selflessness, and causality. So he really did not agree with them, and he did not also accept the notion of emptiness. So he certainly very clearly stated that He was not agreeing with that. So we may wonder, what then in the Buddhist tradition is duality that one has to go beyond? Not the duality only of subject and object, not the duality of Atman and Brahman. You see, that's not the vision of the Buddhist tradition. So what is that that one need to go beyond? Not to stop at this duality which is confusion. So in one sutra, again, one of the earlier sutra, and maybe that's at the clearest statement, the Buddha speaks about one monk, Kachana. Kachana asked the Buddha a question, said, one speak of right view, but what is right view? And the Buddha said, in this world, there are two opposite. There is existence and non-existence. So it exists and does not exist. It is and it is not. Said. But when one sees the arising of experience, of phenomena, one does not hold on to non-existence. And one sees the disappearance of phenomena, one does not hold to existence. And he said, that is the middle way taught by the Buddha. The middle way is between it exists, it does not exist, between existence and non-existence. In most of the system where duality is being questioned, finally one reached to unity. Unity of the Brahman or God, oneness or the oneness of some philosopher. But here, in the Buddhist tradition, non-duality does not lead to oneness. Non-duality does not lead to any ultimate truth. So in a sense, it's much less to grasp. We are left with nothing, left with nothing. We cannot grasp at nothing because it's neither nothing, neither nor something. So there's nothing that can be grasped. And if you like, in the meditation we've been exploring, that it's really taking that into account. And we meet, of course, in our practice, the tendency to want to grasp onto something. I am willing to let go of this and that, but what will I get in exchange? And what he says that you don't get anything in exchange but freedom. Freedom is exactly when you don't hold on to anything. So I think it's very important to see this aspect that non-duality in the Buddhist tradition does not lead to unity, to oneness. I know we can find some texts in the Buddhist tradition where one speaks about oneness, but here following the earlier sutra in Nagarjuna also, I think that is very clear, and also this sutra I've quoted here. So as we cannot say about anything it exists or it does not exist, then it is possible to say that nothing comes into being or goes out of being, but is not because there is ultimate only the Brahman exists, you know. Just because we cannot state as it exists or it does not exist. And I think that is quite sharp in a sense. And important to understand this view so that one is not looking for something to grasp, but another truth, a deeper experience, looking for something. Again, it doesn't say there is nothing, doesn't say there is something, it's beyond any grasping. Doesn't mean that things disappear suddenly. It's a way of being in the world which is different. Yet the world does appear exactly the same way. not suddenly that it appear in a strange way, just a way to be in the world, as non-grasping, as not stating anything. The need to state, it is this way, it is this way, it exists, it does not exist. This is beyond this need to grasp in any way. This is quite challenging. In one of the earlier sutra expressing the Madhyamika philosophy, the Vimalakirti Nirdesha, this is expressed sometimes in challenging way. Manjushri, the great bodhisattva wisdom, questioning Manjushri, questioning Vimalakirti, ask him, so, what is the path that a bodhisattva follow to reach awakening? He is speaking about a bodhisattva hoping that it is somebody skillful. So how does a bodhisattva follow a way to reach awakening? And Vimalakirti, who is very smart in the story, says it is by following a wrong path that a bodhisattva reaches awakening. By following a wrong path. So this is quite a strange statement. So what can it mean? Not like a kind of those Zen story that we never understand a word. You know? But what does it mean? Following a wrong path. Yeah, and you say about the bodhisattva that seems to be someone skillful. But the notion of a right path and a wrong path is already holding to some kind of truth. If things we cannot say, they exist or not exist. So the notion of a right path or wrong path, and the notion of a path also, is misleading. So there is no right path or wrong path to be followed, no path to be followed. Because then it seems that there will be something to reach that does really exist, and something to get rid of that does really exist. Yet if one were to believe that, one would be in deep confusion. One need to see that, not to believe it. To believe it, it's absurd. It's not a belief. It need to be a vision. And then it is an experience, then it is freedom. If it is a belief, it's the deepest kind of bondage one can have. One then would do any kind of stupid thing, think there is, I just follow the wrong path, you know. And that, of course, would be very dangerous, leading just to more and more confusion. So the difficulty in aborting that kind of right view, which is quite sharp and steep, is that to understand it is not the point, is to see it, to experience it. I don't know if experiencing is the right word, but to see it, and then this seeing, this vision is freedom. But to believe it is confusion. And we know very well when traveling in the Dharma seed, as we hear people giving those statements, everything is empty and things like that, as if it were explaining everything. Again, as a belief, is quite confusing. So now, to speak about this right view, it is not to believe, but to experience, we may also wonder, so how can there be experience if there isn't really no right path and wrong path? So how can it be experience? And there, I think we'll need to come down to earth and to see. It's not because I'm trying to convince myself of something, but not trying to believe it, but to see it. I may really get a headache, you know, trying to do that, you know, convincing without convincing me. But I think there are many practices that we can do in order to bring the condition that may allow this vision to arise within us. And that's why we come down to earth. So now what can we do to make the condition possible for such a vision to arise. Not to create this vision, not to cause it, but at least that we give the situation proper that may allow that to happen. And then we can get to practice, like metta practice. We need some opening. We'll see all the practice that are questioning some element of our confusion. So by opening the space, holding less to deeper state of confusion, then we may bring the situation proper that such realization may arise. But if we don't have this right view, this possibility of that happen, then we cannot be open to this situation, because we are going to look for something to grasp some kind of ultimate experience, ultimate condition. So the need of the expression of this right view is that if the situation is proper, then that can happen. But if we believe that the right view is, for example, we should really discover ultimate consciousness, pure consciousness, then we cannot be open to something that is beyond being and non-being. Because we'll hold on to that, and believing that's it, that the ultimate truth. And I believe it does require a fluidity of mind, a letting go very, very deep, in order that become a vision and not a belief. So we have tried today to explore a little bit the practice from a kind of ultimate point of view, just seeing that whatever we believe that can be helpful or harmful, it's a sense of we give reality to that, and then we try to play one against the other, promoting that can be helpful and trying to get rid of that which could be harmful, giving them true reality. And it is very interesting inquiry to see that behind this manipulation of experience, there is a belief that those have some existence. And it's striking sometimes to discover that. Then I believe they are really helpful. They are really harmful. Yet sometimes when one has not the sensitivity for that, it is difficult. We wonder, so what I'm supposed to be doing? I try not to do anything, but still I do something. It doesn't lead anywhere, so I try again to do something. I get my toolbox that I'm used to, but then I'm not so confident because I'm not supposed to use a toolbox. So one is get a bit confused. So I think tomorrow we'll go on with this attitude, and also bringing some element that can help to bring the condition that it is possible that may be a vision and not a belief.